This week on Future of Sex.
Okay, my personal relationship to female promiscuity. Thanks for that.
How much familiarity do you need to for you to be sexually aroused? So can you look at a stranger in a corner and go like, I want it, that you barely knew? Or you have to get to know someone? So do you need like a 4-minute conversation like speed dating? Or do you need like just a chat for the evening and then you could go home with someone? Or you need to know them for like a whole semester in college in order for you to feel sexually aroused?
I think the double standard that exists, you know, can really be summarized in terms of the word slut versus stud.
I just had this urge to say, but why do I mate multiply? Because I definitely do. And I knew that if I turned around, the professor would see me turning around and saying to all the other women, can I get a witness that women mate multiply? So that was really what got me started. It was this personal feeling that there's no way that this science is unbiased, but it's being presented as a fact. And I knew, as all women knew sitting there, that it couldn't be true, but I also knew that I felt enormously constrained against saying it.
Hey, I'm Bryony, and welcome to Future of Sex, the podcast that explores the evolving worlds of sex and tech. Now, season one is over, but before we start season two, we have a special surprise for you. This is our bonus salon series episodes. It's a series of episodes that feature our live recordings. Now, we'll be releasing these over the next few weeks to get you all warmed up for our second season. The format is a little different to what you're used to because I'll be interviewing 3, sometimes 4 people at any one time in front of a live audience. But of course, I didn't want you to miss out just because you weren't in the room. So, before we get started, we just want to remind you, this podcast contains explicit language and adult themes. So please make sure you've got headphones on if there are little ones around. Now, a little primer before we get stuck into our first episode. I remember this day well because the event was held at Williamsburg Hotel during a freak storm. So everyone that made it out in the middle of summer, and there was about 80 of us in the room, had been thoroughly soaked by the rain. And we also had this great demo station set up to try out Bedoink's new virtual sexology program for women. Now, if you haven't heard of this before, virtual sexology is a program in VR that takes you through a series of exercises to get in touch with your body. It's designed by one of my favorite sex therapists and a somatic therapist too. She also features in a couple of episodes. Her name is Dr. Holly Richmond. So if you want to try out virtual sexology designed by Dr. Holly Richmond for women, head to virtualsexology.com. But back to the discussion at hand. The topic for this event was unraveling female promiscuity. Now, all 3 of the panelists were chosen because they are outspoken on the topics of female lust, female desire, and promiscuity. So, what does it mean to be promiscuous? Is it natural? And why is it so different between men and women? Let's get to it. I am particularly interested in, I didn't choose these guys out of nowhere, I'm particularly interested in their work they're doing, and they all come from various fields, from researching sex to a sex hacker that watches couples have sex and looks at how they could be better, to a feminist pornographer who creates amazing print magazines from a female point of view. So they all come from various fields, and I want to ask them some specific questions. It'd be greedy. But I also want you guys to think about the questions that you'd like to ask them. So I'll ask some questions and then I'll hand it over to you guys to ask some questions. And then hopefully we'll all be very satisfied. All right, welcome guys. Fancy director chair. All right. Dr. Wednesday Martin, we're going to start with you. You are a researcher, a writer, a sociologist of female sexuality for the past 2 decades. Wednesday wrote the book Primates of Park Avenue, where she studied Upper East Side women, mummies, yummy mummies, and their sexual habits. And she's now releasing a new book called Untrue, which studies female non-monogamy. So Wednesday's pretty immersed in female lust, infidelity, behaviours. And I want to start off with a bit of a personal question. What is your relationship to female promiscuity?
Can I just say thank you to you for having us all here and for always thank you, bringing together people in interesting ways. I've never sat with a sex hacker and a female pornographer before, so thank you for that. And thanks to you guys, because I can't wait to hear what you have to say. And I just want to thank everybody for coming. People came here in the rain on a Monday night in New York, so thank you for that. And especially I want to thank the women in this room, because the women in this room came through a rainstorm and 12,000 years of constraint against you thinking of yourself as sexually autonomous, which is what you're doing tonight. So thank you. Okay, my personal relationship to female promiscuity. Thanks for that question.
Yeah, just going to throw that in there. Let's go.
I live my work. I do immersive participant observation. When I was a stepmother, it was really hard. I had to figure that out. When I was a mommy on the Upper East Side, that was really hard. I had to figure that out. And then I thought, wow, I've written about these two groups of women that everyone hates. I've written about stepmothers, and I've written about rich women. What's left? I better write about adulteresses. So that's how I came to that. But my really personal relationship to female promiscuity was when I was an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, and there was this lecture, and it was a great time to be studying anthropology at the University of Michigan, and the professor, who shall remain unnamed, said in the lecture, huge lecture hall, I was a priss, so I always sat in the front, and he said, as we know from Angus Bateman, males benefit from mating multiply. They just have tons of sperm to burn, and they're not constrained by pregnancy and gestation, and it just is of benefit to them to mate with as many females as possible. Females, as we all know, do not benefit from mating multiply. They're burdened with gestation, they're burdened with lactation, and they just have this one super precious egg, and they just want the one great guy. So as we know, females don't benefit from multiple mating, so they don't mate multiply. And I just had this urge to say, but why do I mate multiply? Because I definitely do. And I knew that if I turned around, the professor would see me turning around and saying to all the other women, can I get a witness that women mate multiply? So that was really what got me started. It was this personal feeling that there's no way that this science is unbiased, but it's being presented as a fact. And I knew, as all women knew sitting there, that it couldn't be true, but I also knew that I felt enormously constrained against saying it. So that was a long answer.
It's perfect. So the common perception, I think, out there is that men are wired to be promiscuous and women are wired to be monogamous. So I'm curious, in your research so far, how far down the rabbit hole have you gone with the research and looking at how women are wired?
You know, I think that if you're interested in social science, the idea of saying that humans are hardwired one way or wired, it's a little bit problematic. The emphasis now is on the interaction between biology and culture, and we've sort of thrown out the nature-nurture debate, and now we talk about how these factors interact with one another. That said, if there's one thing we can say about human sexuality, it's that we can't say one thing. Humans evolved as flexible sexual and social strategists. And that is the only thing you can say. You can go somewhere and there's polyandry. You can go somewhere else and there's polygyny. You can go somewhere where there's situational...
Can you define those two? Because I'm a total noob.
Polyandry is when a woman has more than one male partner. Polygyny is when a man, polygamy is when a man does. So there are arrangements like that. And then there's more micro level flexibility. Some people, you know, get off on diapers. And we have a really wide sexual menu on a macro and a micro level. And anthropologists would say, well, yeah, that's because we evolved as flexible sexual strategists. And that's why we're here in Homo erectus. Bit the dust. So if we're wired in any particular way, it's to be flexible. However, the really interesting developments in anthropology in the last 40 years have been primatologists and anthropologists realizing that it is probably that we have it exactly wrong, and that if we're wired in any particular way, that it is women who evolved to be sexually promiscuous. I guess we'll talk about the word later, because it conferred all kinds of benefits to an early female hominin and to a non-human female primate to be promiscuous depending on her ecological circumstances. She could hedge against getting crappy sperm if she got sperm from lots of different males. She could hedge against not getting the heterozygosity that she needs to have a robust pregnancy that succeeds. She could hedge against the risk of infanticide if a lot of males thought that maybe they were the father. We know from the data they would be much less likely to kill that offspring. Infanticide is a selection pressure. So these are just, and also if you mated with multiple males, you would have a better chance of them provisioning you, which meant you would have a better chance of reproducing again more quickly. All in all, down the line, being promiscuous was a really great, smart strategy for a female primate. So that just, and that's in the last 40 years that primatologists have realized that and started to emphasize it a lot.
It's so interesting because you're describing the past and I'm thinking about the future, and I think they pretty much line up. Like the way you could be talking about the future when you're describing what you're talking about and hedging bets and all the things that technology provide to be able to find the ultimate partner or partners. Anyway, I'm going to introduce our other guests, so we're not, I could talk to Wednesday all day, but we have an international sex hacker, celebrity personal trainer and sex educator. First of all, Kenneth, I adore Kenneth Clay. I get this question when I tell everyone that you're coming on the panel, what does a sex hacker do? So I'm just going to let you answer that.
I think sex hacking has been happening throughout human history. If you look at in India, that's Kama Sutra. In Taoist, they have their own unique sexual practices to modern day kink. I think one of my favorite sex hacking stories is back in the Victorian time when they diagnosed women with hysteria. So they come up with an awesome solution, which we get to celebrate today as the vibrator. So, I think Hitachi won the game on that one. But it came from about solving, how do you increase sexual pleasure or have clever ways to have better sex, the enjoyment of sex. So if sex is allowed to be celebrated and you could enjoy it, then the hackers are out to how to make it better. Just like food, you could eat really terrible tasting food and you could still survive, but you have celebrity chef who is really into making it an incredible experience. So for me, I think of sex hacking as how do you increase this incredible experience for people to enjoy if they're really into sex, but also celebrate people who are not that into sex, and not everybody needs to dive into it. Not everybody who is that into cheese go to a cheese convention, but you might have some, a cheese sandwich on Thursday. So
I like it. Oh, could you share like a quick sex hack, or is it actually what you're talking about is very specific to the couple and the person?
Well, there's so many different kind of sex hack, and one of my favorite one lately, I've been immersed in this all-women's retreat called Back to the Body in New Orleans that I helped my mentor, Pamela Messon, put together, and it's focused on female pleasure in the most luxurious way possible, right, for 6 days. And
what does that mean?
So they get something, they get an hour and a half worth of sexological body work, which is a type of erotic massage that really focuses on arousal. So arousal has kind of been my favorite hack. So we could build a lot of toys and tools to focus on their tactile data, like the sensation you feel. But if you're not aroused, right, if you're not really turned on, their experience is completely different. So focusing on their arousal rather than just always the technical part, right? Being a sex hacker, sometimes I focus a lot on their teaching of the technical side. But what I learned from working that retreat is the arousal is where it is at, you know, where I see people not so much focusing on like I need to have, you know, 76 orgasm in this 90-minute session, but how long can I stay turn on and arouse and experiencing pleasure? Now I want you to think about in your own sex life, how long can you sustain in that state of pleasure and experience? So I think hacking that is amazing.
Is that just for women or is that a...
For both sex. Mm. But unfortunately, their orgasm gap is so huge that I think most women are the one who left, you know, hanging in that, you know, in that formula. So I don't... There's not enough research out there actually on female pleasure, on sex and stuff. And they're, you know, the whole clitoracy movement is happening and we're learning more about the clit. And I wish Mel was here.
She's somewhere.
So we're still learning and there's so much more to learn about female arousal and how to pleasure. And there's also a really native Indian teaching. It's called, if I might butcher this, I'm just learning about it, Kadushka, which learning about all the different vulva type, like how do you look at a genital, right? And then ID them, like what are the distance between the clitoris and the vaginal opening to how much labia do you have to your arousal pattern to how wet do you get and your orgasming pattern and not treating every vulva and vagina exactly the same way, but also look at it from a typing perspective, which on the scientific side, I have such an issue with it because then you narrow their, you typing people. But I think if more people get to learn about looking at genitals, not treating every genital the same way, that's a huge sex hack. Like if you have this type of, you know, genitals and you prefer this type of sensation, you should focus on this instead of sex guru, which I really hate, that you should try this tip and it will work for everybody. The magazine tip drives me crazy because it's not based on individuality, you know, and personalize it.
What a glorious segue to Mackenzie Peck, who is the creator of Math Magazine and a celebration of female sexuality and different body types. And if you haven't seen Math Magazine, it's over there. It's a beautiful print magazine. Feminist pornography is how I would describe it. All photographers that are involved in these shoots have to also strip down to their underwear or take their underwear off. It's ethical, it's positive. It's exactly the opposite of what we're seeing in other media where, I mean, there's so much talk of hookup culture, but when we shine a light on hookup culture for women, it's often very shaming. We're putting women in a less positive light than men where it's player. But I'm so curious because you're a media creator and you're sort of defining that way, how you go about this and how you think about the media that's coming out around promiscuity and indiscriminate sex and love. Yeah. Added in love there.
Did you add in love at the last minute?
That's me being cute.
I love love.
Me too.
Well, I should say I have a few copies for sale, just a few if anyone's interested.
Can everyone hear?
And to answer your question, I think, you know, the double standard that exists, you know, can really be summarized in terms of the word slut versus stud. And I find it infuriating. But what I try to focus on as a real free love hippie is creating a safe space for all people. So I think it's important to recognize that as much as women suffer injustices in the world of sexual freedom, so do men. You know, like being on a dating site with my boyfriend, you know, guys have trouble talking about wanting anal play because it's taboo. Or even the idea of being a little bit more emotionally available or romantically available is difficult for men as well. So I think that there are double standards on both sides. And what I try to do is create a really welcoming community where we're able to be free to talk about whatever the hell we want and do whatever the hell we want.
But how do you do it? Like, how do you go about that? And how do you think about for men as well, creating something different?
Yeah, I think the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. You know, I am very focused on the idea of representing everyone in every issue. So if the magazine had an orientation, it would be pansexual. I work really hard to show a diversity of body types and sexual interests and sexual practices all the time. And the way that we speak about what we do, the way that I talk about the process and the content is really, like, I take the time to spell things out. You know, I think some language, while it can be great for being specific, it can also be a little bit isolating or intimidating, you know, like needing to understand like polyamory or the word queer can be really intimidating for someone. And I try to take the time to talk things out and be truly inclusive, you know, to somebody in the middle America where they can't have access to information or resources. And I ship all over the world, so I see where these magazines go. And
where do they go?
Sometimes I look at Street View of like the actual home and like try to understand, because it's hard. It's so abstract for me. You know, I'm making shipments, printing labels, and I kind of forget that there are people whose lives are impacted by representation and seeing all the different ways we can express ourselves and explore our sexuality. That doesn't even have words. You know, the nameless things, I think, are the most exciting.
The discussion is about promiscuity and that word, the power behind that word and the meaning behind that word when you say promiscuous woman versus a promiscuous man. And the interpretation of that, is that a good word? Is that a crap word? Should we just throw it out? What do you think?
I have some thoughts about that just from the viewpoint of anthropology and primatology. A lot of those scientists will say that they're just using the term promiscuous neutrally, which is a really bold, weird claim that you could use that term neutrally. And some people do still use the term. I had a researcher do a literature search for me on the term promiscuity within the field of primatology. And I said to him, let's do a search of the literature and see how many times promiscuous is applied to male non-human primates and how many times it's applied to females. And it was applied to a lot more males. So that shows a certain blindness to understanding that female primates do mate multiply. So it cuts many different ways how problematic that word is. But when I was interviewing Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy, who, if anybody in here likes the book Sex at Dawn, go to the primary source, which is Sarah Hurdy. And she's one of the great theorists of female sexual promiscuity. And she's spun the cooperative breeding hypothesis out of it, and she spun...
What is the cooperative breeding
hypothesis? The cooperative breeding hypothesis is that we evolved as cooperative breeders. We evolved not in a heterosexual dyad, raising our kids in a cave and the man brought the food, right? But we evolved in these rangy, multi-band groups of people that we mated multiply so that we would raise our offspring multiply, which really conferred a really great benefit to us as a species. And a lot of anthropologists believe that that promiscuous mating by females and cooperative breeding are sort of the method and the way, and that they go together. So to make a long story short, I had this great opportunity to interview her, and I was so surprised and that she had agreed, and so excited. And I said, you know, my subtitle has the word female infidelity in it. What's a better word than infidelity? And she said, I don't know. And I said, well, what's a better term than promiscuity? And she looked for a minute and she said, instead of promiscuity, we should say assiduously maternal. And I was like, that doesn't help, I can't say. But what she meant was, in our evolutionary prehistory, which was just before 12,000 years ago, which to these anthropologists is like yesterday, the best mother was what we call a promiscuous mother. She was playing the field the right way. She was running that calculus about how can I get the best protection for myself and my offspring? How can I reproduce again? It might have been an unconscious calculus, but it was a really important part of the calculus. So then I said, okay, Sarah, no, seriously, what is the definition of promiscuity? And she said, promiscuity is just a word that's used to describe somebody that other people think is having too much sex, and it's usually a woman. So that's another take on that word. I'm not crazy about the word.
Love it.
Wow, so much to say. The part about being indiscriminate really bothers me, because to me, someone who's sexual, especially a woman who's sexually adventurous, I mean, my assumption is that her sexual palate is more developed, so she wouldn't just take any crappy, you know, hookups. So hopefully. On the Casual Sex Project, our Dr. Jana, I'm so privileged to be like working with her, because I think she is like the PhD of casual sex. And one of the key distinctions is called sociosexual orientation. So either you are restricted or unrestricted, and you're somewhere in the spectrum. So what it means is that how easily are you aroused, right, by strangers or new people that you don't know. So there's, and do you mind if I geek out a little bit?
I love geeking out.
And I want you to ask yourself that question, right? How much familiarity do you need for you to be sexually aroused? So can you look at a stranger in a corner and go like, I want it, that you barely knew? Or you have to get to know someone. So do you need like a 4-minute conversation, like speed dating? Or do you need like just a chat for the evening and then you could go home with someone? Or you need to know them for like a whole semester in college in order for you to feel sexually aroused? The second part is, how much emotional connection do you need for you to be sexually aroused? Being actually just turned on. Not what you think is good or bad, but being aroused, right? So do you really need to feel a lot of emotional connection or deep understanding? Or the fact that you don't have much emotional connection is a turn on. And the third part is that, how much commitment do you need in order for you to be sexually aroused? Do you have to marry that person? Do you need to the least date? Do you need to see this person again for you to be sexually aroused or invest in having sex? So what's the research though is that everybody's somewhere different on that scale, right? So not every woman is, or any person is, so that some of us are super unrestricted. So I am one of those types of super unrestricted. I don't need to know you or have that much emotional connection, or I need a commitment. I think it's kind of a nightmare if I have to marry everyone that I ever had sex with. Yeah. So, because I don't need much, and I could be sexually aroused, it allows like casual sex makes sense for me. But I know a lot of people that doesn't work for them. So you kind of have to define on what works for you and how unrestricted you are. And the research is interesting is that there's a dopamine receptor that you could see like how easily you get aroused by novelty, by new things in general. Like, are you always into the shiny object? Like in general, you're more likely to want casual sex. So that whole reward system.
That's so interesting, yeah. Because so they're measuring the physical as well as what you're perceiving. Like, yeah.
The other side interesting is, just because you crave casual sex, right? Most people still are into pair bonding. They want long-term relationships. So let people believe that if you want casual sex, therefore you're avoiding romantic love or long-term relationship. It's not true. They're just two separate things. So you could really into having a long-term sustainable relationship while you want to have sex with a new person once a week. Like, it totally could happen together. So they're just different type of people out in the world. And at least on their study, what Jana have shown me, there's slightly more, on the male side, there's more unrestricted, like they're sluttier bunch. And then there's slightly more women on their more conservative side or less or more unrestricted. But as in total, there's still majority of the people want some type of novelty And most people want stability. So at least that's what the number is showing.
Can I say something about this point about novelty and variety of sexual experience, which I think is really important? Most of us, if you're a certain age, were sold a bill of goods that men crave variety and novelty of sexual experience. They just get bored so quickly. They want to nail anything that they can. And that women crave a companionate, connected, deep relationship. I was shaken to my core when I interviewed one of my first interview subjects, 58-year-old Catholic woman, a traditional Irish Catholic family, Long Island, and she had a low sex drive. And I said, can we talk about your low sex drive? And she said, oh, I just say that in front of my husband and the doctor. I don't have a low sex drive. I want to have sex all night long, every night, with a different guy. And she is not exceptional. What we have found now, what Meredith Miana found in her research lab in Las Vegas, and what Meredith Chivers has found in her lab at Queen's University in Canada, is that women need variety and novelty of sexual experience more than men do, and that monogamy is a tighter fit for women than for men. But because of the envelope of constraint, it's easier for them to simply perceive, oh, I have a low sex drive. Men in the aggregate will report sexual satisfaction in a long-term relationship when they're getting sex regularly. Women in the aggregate in a long-term relationship having sex regularly will report, I'm bored, if they're honest, or I just have a really low sex drive if they don't want to say that and haven't allowed themselves to see that. So when it comes to variety and novelty, there's so much ideological constraint that women sometimes can't even recognize they're craving for it. But oh my God, the way you guys are going like this, the women in the room, and even those of you who aren't, we are creatures. I always like to think that when women are fucking or doing whatever we're doing in bed, we are in bed with millions of years of our early hominin, our Holocene and Pleistocene female ancestors who had to game their sexuality and did it to great effect, and for whom it was really adaptive to seek out variety and novelty. And that software, it doesn't matter if Donald Trump is president, honey. That software is still in there, and he can't take it out. So,
how PG-13 do I need to be? Not at all. Okay.
I just said the F word.
So I talk a lot about gangbang and producing gangbang, where there's significantly more male energy for one or two women, or parties where the ratio is like 1-4. It works out really, really well. And where there's more, more abundant of male sexual energy to serve a smaller number around of women, it's really functional and it's really fun.
Does that resonate with you too? What are the most common sort of female fantasies or feedback that you get for the magazine?
Female fantasies that I get?
Yeah.
Interesting. The last issue, I had the best possible problem. I had too many short stories that featured a strong female role, sort of taking control of her sexual life, that I had to like push them to the next issue. So it's a very good trend to see. Mm. But I don't know. I'm really excited to see, stories about very... like average, relatable experiences, kink can be very exciting, but just hearing about a person going on speed dating and deciding to hand the man across from her panties and like screw on a baseball field and then be like, okay, bye, that's special to me. Versus like that, so that was in the most recent issue, by the way, versus like a story about like gangbangs or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think being really relatable and can kind of creating a bridge between the everyday world and personal lives, that more of us experience, I think is really special and can have the bigger impact in terms of this bubble and expanding this idea of acceptance.
Mm.
I remember doing a search on Pornhub. They always do a summary of the most commonly searched terms, and they did one for women. I think it was 2015 or 2016, the most searched terms for women were lesbian, gangbang, hardcore, and spanking. And I was like, wow, women are full of surprises. And then but not really. And then I kept reading the article, and they asked this sex researcher who has a practice in Connecticut, she's a sex therapist, and they asked her what she made of these preferences that women had shown on the internet. And she said, it shows that women, the first term they searched was lesbian, and it shows that women really want connection. And that wasn't what I saw at all when I saw that the search terms were gangbang and rough sex. So it shows you that there's so much constraint, even at the level of somebody, and I'm not putting this woman down, but even a professional whose job is sex research and sex therapy, she was seeing that through a very distorted lens because she has been taught that women seek intimacy even in their fantasies. And I love the idea of a bubble. Being a place where women are free from constraint, like where I met you at Skirt Club.
And that brings our first bonus Salon Series episode to a close. Now, if you're curious about Skirt Club and want to learn more, you can check out this podcast, episode 3 on Skirt Club. And don't forget to check out Bedoink VR's virtual sexology program for women. It's also for men to make you a better lover. Virtual Sexology 1 for men, Virtual Sexology 2 for women, and that's virtualsexology.com for everyone. This podcast was produced and edited by Chad Michael Snavely. To get in touch or check out the other podcasts Chad is producing, visit chadmichael.com. And if you have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hey, you can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Bryony Cole. That's BRYONYCOLE. Until next time.
What's the reality for a woman being promiscuous versus a man?
I think most men, hetero men, or men who enjoy having sex with women, really want to be better. Sometimes we just don't know how, and our only reference is hardcore porn, so it's unfortunate.
You have like me, like a 30-year-old woman who is here to talk to you and like will answer your emails. And like I'm on the Instagram feed being like, hey, taking pictures of people fucking today, what's up? And like, you know, it's totally different and totally human, and we're getting in there, and I'm really enthusiastic about exploring some of these more taboo fantasies, but being really clear about what it means to depict it and to engage with it.
You should enjoy your innervated, forward-facing clitoris. It's never going to let you down because it's not estrogen dependent, and it got the whole world where it is. It was really female sexual pleasure that was one of the largest selection pressures on the human species. So you go out there and you be human.
Thanks for listening. Talk to you all soon.